I am Sam Clements, and welcome to this mini Picture House podcast all about Mimi Leader's new film, On the Basis of Sex. This film is based on the true story of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her early part of her career, as she sort of transitions into the legend that we know today. The film stars Felicity Jones as Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Armie Hammer. We also have Justin Theroux, Sam Waterston, Kathy Bates in the cast as well. Now, this is from director Mimi Leader, who directed Deep Impact way back when, which is a film I really, really loved. And Mimi Leader was in town during the London Film Festival, where I got to have a little chat with her. And then straight after that, we will go into my colleague Sarah Cook's chat with one of the stars of the film, as I mentioned earlier, Armie Hammer, who was in town very, very recently, just before the UK release, to attend a special screening of the movie. So, without further ado, On the Basis of Sex, which is in cinemas right now. Do check it out. It's a film I really, really enjoyed. See you on the other side. Thank you. Good morning, Mimi. Thank you very much for talking to us today on the Picture House podcast.
It's a pleasure to be talking to you. Thank you.
How is your trip to London going so far? I know last night you were at the British Independent Film Awards.
Yeah, and I was at the British Film Awards last night, and it was really fun because the crowd was so full of life and fun and funny, and it had a really great vibe. It, you know, giving awards is always kind of nerve-wracking, but this was just so fun and playful, and everyone's very appreciative and full of praise for each other. It was a it was a real love fest I walked into, and it was really interesting presenting Felicity this incredible award for her incredible body of work and to a British crowd, because I've never done that before.
That must have been amazing. I'm sure she had lots of friends in the audience who would have went wild for that.
Yeah, they went wild for her. Who doesn't?
No, absolutely. I love seeing her progression. When I was a child, she was on children's TV, and I'd see her in programs called The Worst Witch and these sort of things.
Yeah.
And then she made her sort of feature leap with Chalet Girl, which was a really big hit here.
Yeah, I love Chalet Girl. I loved it.
It's a lot of fun, and it always comes out at Christmas time, and people keep playing it and playing it on TV. It's great to see her in these huge movies now, and I think she's got a lot of fans over here.
And in the States. I mean, I think people in the States are very much beginning to know her and respect her because she's one of the greats.
With the role in this film, how did Felicity first sort of, you know, come into your brain as someone who might be suitable for the lead role in On the Basis of Sex?
Yeah, well, Natalie Portman was originally attached to the film, and she dropped out. And then we had a list of actors, like, who should we cast?
Mm.
And I zeroed right into Felicity, because I love her work. And I kept looking at pictures of the younger Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I kept looking at Felicity. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg as a young woman was stunning and beautiful. Mm. And she's still beautiful. I don't mean to say she's not. But as a young woman, she was extraordinarily striking. And I kept putting their pictures side by side. And then I kept watching Felicity's work, and I kept saying, we have to go to Felicity. She can do this. I just had a feeling. Mm. I just had a hunch. And I sent it to her on a Friday, and she said yes on a Monday.
Wow.
and that's very rare. And I know she'd been looking for something to really dig her teeth into. You know, this year is an interesting year for women. There's a lot of good women's roles. But normally there's not an abundance of really great roles for women.
Mm.
And so she tackled this in a very deep way, you know, listened to hundreds of hours of tapes of RBG and really studied her physicality. And she worked hard. And it was really interesting because the voice of a young RBG, we do not have any tapes of. We only have her from her Supreme Court cases that she fought. This movie takes place before all of that. And so we went for a mid-Atlantic accent, and the justice loved her accent and loved her performance and said she couldn't imagine anyone playing her except for Felicity Jones, which was a huge compliment.
That's incredible, especially, you know, for a British actor as well to sort of come in and have to deal with not just a role, but the accent and all of that extra stuff.
I believe the justice was, you know, do you think she can do it, you know, with the American accent? And we assured her she could. And then you start thinking, oh my God, I hope she can. But she did. She did.
Can you remember what your first conversation with Felicity was after she accepted the role?
You know, we spoke on the phone. I was in Los Angeles and she was in London. And I actually can't remember the very first conversation. But then we met in Los Angeles. She flew out to meet me. And I just, you know, found an exuberance in her and a spirit that was so enthusiastic and so strong. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a real truth seeker. She believed in the truth. And I felt that Felicity possessed that quality. And she actually really took it to that level.
How much research did you want Felicity to do herself, and how much did you just want her to, you know, look at what's on the page?
Well, I didn't have to tell her to do any research. She just jumped in and listened to hundreds of hours of recordings of an older Ruth Bader Ginsburg with her dialect coach. And, you know, I sent her books to read about RBG, the notorious RBG, and the justice had just come out with her own book called In Her Own Words. So she, you know, she dug deep into who she was. And, you know, our writer, Daniel Stiepelman, is Ruth's nephew. And so we looked to him for a lot of insight into, you know, his aunt. But, you know, then you realize, well, he's only like 36 years old, you know. It's a different kind of insight into a marriage that began in the 50s and what kind of marriage that was. And they truly had an equal partnership, her and Marty, the love of her life partner, as she called him when she was sworn in as the justice in 1993. Their relationship was an equal partnership and, you know, a real metaphor for our film. And I know that when I know from Daniel that, you know, admiring his aunt and uncle, he wanted to have a marriage like theirs.
Oh, wow.
You know, and he strived for it. You know, we all do. That is strong and loving. And this movie is very much about how love prevails. And it's also about how change can happen.
Absolutely. It's great what you say about how Dan sort of looks at their relationship, because in the film, you do such a good job of creating that loving family unit. And I was sat there watching it going like, that's what I want in my relationship. You know, it's like an aspirational balance there. And it's great to watch.
Thank you. Yeah. I felt, you know, when you hire actors and you know, you're going, I believe they can really get this, but you never really know until you're in rehearsal, until they're on screen. And, you know, Armie and Felicity had an extraordinary chemistry and they worked hard on it. And I mean, they're both really great actors, and I think we were all very fortunate that it came together in the way that it did, because it doesn't always. You know, I think they are both in Felicity got married after the movie, but it was in a very loving relationship. And Armie's is married. And I think when you're in a deep, deep relationship full of love, you have an understanding of what love really means on so many different levels, you know. And then you hope it translates, you know, on film.
Absolutely. How long after Felicity's casting did Armie come on board?
Right away. I was in a casting meeting at WME, which is his agency, and they had a book full of pictures of, well, it could be this guy, it could be that guy. And I went right to Armie's picture and I said, it's this guy, because I knew I was such a huge fan of his from The Social Network. And I just loved his height difference.
Yes.
Because RBG is very tiny, and so is Felicity. And I wanted to, you know, have those that different height distance in the frame, which is very hard to achieve in a frame. Like, how do you hold them both in the frame when the height difference is so strong? But it was really a challenge and fun. And I knew that Army had this charming, lovely, funny side to him that we hadn't seen yet on the screen. And he brought it. And it's really interesting because, you know, Marty was the funny one and Ruth was the shy one. And they really made, you know, the opposites really attracted, really came together.
There's a line in the film about the height difference, I think, as well. I think he says, you know, but you are very small. And like that, how they can be so honest with each other, and so it's so charming.
Yeah, and funny.
Which is great, because the film is about a very serious thing, and the fact that they can still have fun, you know,
Absolutely.
And he can bounce his way through all of these scenarios. Did you have as much sort of historical stuff to work with for Marty as you do for RBG?
Yes. You know, Marty became the preeminent tax attorney in the country. And, you know, while his career flourished, you know, she couldn't get a job as an attorney and wasn't taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And so she took a job at Rutgers and taught contracts law. And then she, you know, started a class on gender discrimination. And it was the first of its time. And, you know, taught generations to be lawyers and to be feminists. And it's always what she wanted to be. I mean, she was a lawyer, but she wanted to change the world. Hence that scene where Marty says, what's wrong with you being a teacher? Mm. And she wanted more, and she had more to give.
So her response in that scene is incredible. It really sort of makes you sit up in your chair, and because you're like, yeah, they're getting by. This is fine. And then you realize what's really at stake. And you're suddenly like so much more invested in her goals, and the film sort of picks up a pace, I think, after that for her to get that goal.
Yeah, that was the pivotal scene that sends her off into finding this case. But he found it. He brought it to her, and Justice Ginsburg was very much a stickler on that we get the law exactly how it happened and the story how it happened. Because at one point, Daniel had written a scene where she finds the case and Justice Ginsburg said, no, that's not how it happened. That's a deal breaker.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And so then he rewrote it, and that's how it happened.
It's such a unique opportunity, I guess, to have a screenplay by the nephew of the subject in the film.
It really was a unique experience. And you know, he was very malleable, and we worked hard on the script to make it as authentic as we could and as dramatic as we could.
In what form did it come to you? Did he already have a few drafts under his belt, and there was a sort of a complete screenplay that you went through together?
Yeah, several drafts before me. And then I came on and we did several more drafts for almost a year. And then we got it to a place where it was greenlit, and there we went, full steam ahead.
Did that final draft go to Justice Ginsburg? How involved were you with her in real life?
Yeah, in real life, Justice Ginsburg was very involved in the script and absolutely was a stickler on getting the law right. I mean, her character, fine, everything was fine. It was the law.
Right.
And Marty. You know, Marty was the love of her life, and she wanted Marty to be depicted true to form.
It sounds like, as well as being maybe, you know, a creatively fulfilling experience, probably quite an educational experience as well, with the real-life laws that would sort of come your way.
Absolutely. I mean, Justice Ginsburg is really proud of the film, and I think that's the biggest praise I think we could ever receive, is that she is proud of the film. And proud of her story. That's truly amazing.
Absolutely. I think for audiences over here who won't be as familiar with her, it's such a great, you know, crash course in this really important moment, and it inspires you to go and learn more. And I think that's testament to the film as well. You know, on the way home from the screening, I was online just reading as much as I possibly could, desperate to find out more.
I believe that. You know, everybody wants to know more about her, even Americans. You know, I mean, obviously, in the last 11, 12 years, she's become a cult figure in America. But and even me, I knew a lot about her, but I didn't know her personal life. I did not know this story. And it was thrilling. And I think generations to come will be Googling her and looking her up and, you know, looking at this, truly heroic character, an icon who changed the world for so many people, for so many women, and, you know, changed the world for women with equal rights, social justice, and always the truth seeker.
I'm a bit of a soundtrack nerd, and I loved the score for this film.
You did?
I was thinking, like, I need to download this on the way home. I need to buy a copy of this. But can you remember what conversations you had about, you know, the soundtrack for this?
Absolutely. Movie? You know, Michael Dana is our composer, and he's a genius. And, you know, he said, let's go non-traditional. And we wanted a classical score because they loved, it just felt right for the film, classic and classical. And, you know, what you would normally attribute to a man in a score is the drums, the snares. Mm. And we really went with that for her and gave her that power. And it's a very emotional score as well. It really feeds into the emotionality of her character and supports her work. And I was just very, very pleased and very much loved Michael Dana. And Kesha, who wrote the end song, Here Comes the Change, I was just flabbergasted. You know, we talked, and in 3 hours she wrote the song.
Well, that's amazing.
and you know, we wanted it vintage and a little throwback to Bob Dylan with the harmonica. Mm. And she just nailed it. And she's, you know, she's a real activist and really understood the nature of what the song needed to be. Mm. I mean, it's uplifting. It's an anthem. I wanted an anthem. Please give me an anthem. And so she did. It's a song that speaks to how far we've come and how much farther we have to go.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Mimi, for this great film and for the amazing anthem. As you're right, it absolutely is. It made me stay in my seat for the end credits.
Really? That's wonderful.
But highly recommend seeking out the soundtrack, listeners, and seeing the film on the big screen. It looks and sounds amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Seems appropriate Valentine's Day to be talking about one of the greatest love and love romances I've ever seen.
It's true. They had an incredible relationship. It's definitely something to aspire to.
Yeah, absolutely. What drew you to this amazing character in the story?
I mean, look, the fact that they were making a movie about Justice Ginsburg was incredible, and I think that she is exactly the kind of person that you should venerate with a film. And Martin, her husband in the movie, not only is he an incredible character in the movie, but he was an incredible character in real life, but also he's a tragically underrepresented character in film. You rarely see a supportive, great husband who believes so much in his smart, capable, intelligent, powerful wife that he would do whatever it took to support her and to sort of foster her success. You don't see that role a lot. And it felt unique and it felt interesting. And it felt like something I wanted to do.
How do you approach a real life character such as Marty away from fictional characters?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Felicity had more of a challenge with it than I did because she was playing someone who is much more recognizable.
Yeah.
But, you know, playing a real person versus playing someone who's fictional, a lot of the times what it means is you just have more access to research. You can talk to people who knew him. You can read what he wrote. You can sort of get to know the character a little bit better than having to just make something up if you're playing a fictional character. So yeah, there are challenges and you want to handle it respectfully because you want to do justice to this person. But on the other hand, like you also have so much more source material.
Yeah. And he's so great. And their dynamic is so interesting because he was this lighthearted, funny character and she was more pragmatic and stern. How did you work with Felicity Jones to develop that? And how did that affect their day-to-day life and family?
They balanced each other out really well because she is very intense and driven and intelligent. And he also was very intelligent and, you know, one of the preeminent tax attorneys of his time. But he handled everything with sort of like a tongue-in-cheekness. You know, he was very funny and pithy and charming. And, you know, they worked together really well.
Yeah, and how did you develop that with Felicity?
We just really kind of honestly, we just spend time with each other, getting to know each other, feeling safe with each other, because, you know, so much of sort of like the actor and actor relationship on camera is about building trust and being comfortable with the other person. So, yeah. You know, we talked about them. We went to coffee. We went to dinner. We just spent time together and got to know each other so that we would feel safe sort of being in these positions.
And his position in that era of being like doing the cooking and being so liberal and letting her do what she needs to do was very different for that time.
Incredibly progressive.
Incredibly progressive. What do you think made him that way? Or do you think he was just so caring and empathetic and loving? And
I mean, he certainly was caring, he certainly was empathetic, but he also was incredibly self-assured and confident. Yeah. And was so self-possessed that he was willing and able to defy the gender norms of the time. You know, I mean, at the time in the 50s and 60s and 70s, really when this movie takes place, men didn't stay home and cook and clean and take care of the kids. It just wasn't the dumb thing. But he just didn't give a shit. He was going to do whatever it took to make sure that his wife accomplished her incredibly important mission. And that kind of shows you how special of a man he was. And also, it sort of gives you something to aspire to. It gives you an idea of what a sort of ideal partner would be.
Has it kind of changed your habits at home then? Are you like, this is...
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I also do a lot of the cooking around the house. Yeah. I take the kids to school, you know, because when I'm working and I'm gone. But when I'm not, I'm home. And I have the luxury of time. So I want to make up for not being there all the time when I'm working. So I want to do all these things and I want to do them. You know, I don't consider the cooking or cleaning around the house to be my wife's job. I want to do it. I want to help. You know, my wife is an incredibly busy woman who's got a lot going on. And that gives me the opportunity to be the one who gets to cook breakfast or dinner or lunch or make the kids, meals for school and all that. Like I love doing all that. So I did it before the movie, but now after the movie, it just, you know, it reinvigorated me.
I was at the screening last night and you said that she now says stuff like, would Marty do that when you're not chivalrous? Or...
Yeah. Martin wouldn't do that, would he? Oh, damn it, you're right. You know.
What would Marty do?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's the way forward. And it's his role and the era. It's so, I mean, fascinating and terrifying that wasn't that long ago. Mm. This era of men being so against women's rights and all these laws. How fascinating was it for you to dig into that? And how terrifying is it that people still have those views these days?
You know, social evolution is a little bit like physical evolution. It doesn't happen all at once. It's a process. If you look at where we were at the time this movie starts, you know, in the 50s and 60s, it was a very different time. And if you really look at where we are now, obviously, the battle for gender equality and actual parity is not accomplished. Like, we're not there. But we have made leaps and strides from the 1950s and 60s. So it gives us an idea. You know, I mean, it's like in math. Like, a dot is a dot, two dots is a line. And with that line, you can sort of track a trajectory of where we need to continue to go. So it's disheartening where we were, and there are certainly things going on now that are very disheartening. But at the same time, I would like to think of myself as a bit of a cautious optimist and say, well, we've made a lot of progress since then, and we now have an idea of the trajectory we need to continue to.
Because there's a big voice in this film of the younger generation, the generation that's coming next, and how we inspire them, which is what Ruth and Marty did, especially with her daughter, Jane. Is there hope that this film, people go to watch this film and will inspire the radical social change that comes next?
Hopefully. Yeah, I mean, that would be the best case scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, fingers crossed. And also working with the legendary Mimi Leader, what was that like?
She was the perfect person to do this. I sat down and had lunch with her and we talked about this project before I signed on. And hearing her story, getting to meet her, getting to talk with her, hearing how she herself had to break through so many glass ceilings and had so many doors closed in her face, it just felt like she was the natural person to do this.
There's just so much goodness stuff in here that she brings. It's written by their nephew. So was there extra pressure there having him write it and then you?
Yes. There definitely was. But also having Daniel Stiepelman, who, as you said, is Ruth and Marty's nephew, having him write it also gave us unprecedented access into their personal life. If anyone else would have written this movie, it would have been a courtroom drama.
Yeah. You
know? But having someone who was intimately aware of, you know, what happened behind closed doors with them, we could go to him and go, Daniel, how do you think that Marty or Ruth would have handled this situation? Or what do you think that he's, well, I can tell you because I've seen them handle that situation and this is how they did it, you know, and you go, okay, good, you know.
talking about people, working with people, you work with Jack Rayner again, and Free Fire is one of my favorite films.
Awesome. I love you. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm working with Ben Wheatley again this year. We're doing a remake of Rebecca, the Hitchcock film.
That's the best news. I love Rebecca. It's a great film. What's it like working with Jack again?
Jack is one of my favorite actors, honestly, to watch, to work with. He's one of my favorite people. We hang out a lot. Like, I really have all the time in the world for Jack Rayner. He's also so frustratingly good at what he does. He's just so natural. And doing a scene with Jack is a treat. You know, I mean, he's so present and so there and such a talented actor. I would do a minuscule, terrible part in a project just to work again with Jack Rayner.
And you're just kind of against each other again in a different way here as well.
Yeah.
So maybe do one where you're actually on the same side.
That would be nice. We were kind of on the same side in Free Fire until he shoots me.
We were talking briefly about the courtroom stuff. There's a lot of great monologues.
I love that you love Free Fire, by the way.
It's just so good. Yeah. My friend does the best Vern impression you've ever seen.
Oh my God.
She's so good. I'm not going to do it because I'm really bad.
Yeah. But I think by the time we finished shooting Free Fire, everyone could do a Charlto impression because it's just so Charlto.
It's so good. And we did the beard oil line, me and my friend, every time we see each other.
Oh, yeah. By the way, that was ad-libbed. That was like this thing where we were wrestling and Killian just kind of goes, "You smell like perfume." I was wearing beard oil because I was like, look, this guy really takes a lot of pride in his beard.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, the beard oil line was improv'd. The joints in the scenes were improv'd. Yeah. It was good fun, that movie.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. So I've got a final question. Obviously, the one you're going to get asked a lot on this junket. What was it like meeting RBG and having her influence on the film, and how did she respond to the movie?
It was intimidating. You know, I mean, she's obviously a force of nature, and she's someone who has shaped the legal landscape of the world that we live in. So getting to meet a legend and a hero like that is kind of daunting, but... You know, I mean, she was incredibly generous with her time. She welcomed us into her private chambers at the Supreme Court and spent a lot of time with us answering any questions we had. Then we went to dinner with her afterwards, and it was fantastic. She's a very, very special woman.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today.
Thank you for liking Free Fire.
I love it so much. Hero. If everyone wants to see Free Fire after On the Basis of Sex, I feel like that's the thing that we need to go watch it.
Or it is a little different from Martin Ginsburg.
Very different. Thank you.